We'll begin with our blessing.
Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu melech haolam Asher bachar banu mikol hamim Ve'na'atan lanu et torato Baruch atah Adonai Notein haTorah.
Amen. Welcome back. All right, it's nice to see all of you. We're on Parshat Vayetze, and we are on page, Cindy? I'm sorry, 145, thank you. Page 145. Just a couple housekeeping things before we begin. We will have class, God willing, next week, and then I will be gone for 2 weeks, God willing, to Israel. But I'll be back during Hanukkah, so I think it's the December 5th, is that Thursday? I think that's the last, is that the last day of Hanukkah, that day?
Yes.
Okay, the last day of Hanukkah. So we'll have class on the last day of Hanukkah, hopefully. And I just wanted to let you know that. Also, I did send out an email to everyone, hopefully you got it, that my website name has changed. I got upgraded to torahchai.net, no more Weebly.com. So torahchai.net, torahchai.net. And it's still being built. It's in progress, but you will be able to, in a way, I hate to announce this because I love it so much more when everybody comes. But if for some reason you can't come, really, really can't come, and you want to listen to the class online, the new feature will be that you will be able to download it as well as listening to streaming it. And I'll also be able to put in links so that if I mention something in class, like a website or something, I'll be able to put the link right on the site for you to go to. So.
How are you going to know how to do that?
Oh, I have a helper and I'm learning these things. torahchai.net. Do not go to torahchai.com. It's a messianic site, so just stay away from that. torahchai.net. Okay. Well, that was the only downside of that name. Okay. Yeah, right, for chai. Okay, that all being said, so feel free to check it out or pass it along to other people. It would be great. And as I said, it's under construction, so it's probably not going to be done for a couple weeks till it's all up, completely in running, but so you know that it's in progress. This week's Parsha, Vayetze, is the Parsha we are continuing with Yaakov. Jacob has now left his home because of Esau being set on wanting to kill him, and so Rachel sends him away with Isaac's blessing to go find a wife for himself from the family where Rebecca and Sarah come from Abraham's family. So that's where he's heading towards there. And the story opens up on page 145, verse 10. And we want to read verses 10 through 12. And we're going to focus on this part as well as two other places to see what we can learn from our father Yaakov and to see how his experiences can help with us. So let's see, who would like to begin to start? Cindy, go ahead.
Yaakov departed to Beersheba and went toward Haran. He encountered the place and spent the night there because the sun had set. He took from the stones of the place which he arranged around his head and lay down in Aphrodis. And he dreamt, and behold, a ladder was set earthward, and its top reached heavenward. And behold, angels of God were ascending and descending.
Okay, great. Okay, so this is a very famous story. Probably lots of people know the story of Jacob's dream, and specifically Jacob's ladder. Okay, the ladder of Jacob. People always speak about that, and we're going to look a little bit more at what happened with this ladder. What is this ladder? What was happening on this ladder? And then also at the end of his dream, we're going to talk about also when he awakens and realizes what the nature is of where we are. We're on page 145. So, when it says he encountered the place and spent the night there because the sun had set, he took from the stones of the place which he arranged around his head. So first of all, there's a midrash that says how many stones were there around his head that he put around? Does anybody remember? 12 stones. It happens it'll be for each of the 12 tribes. When he awakens, we'll see that it's only going to be one stone. And there's a midrash that says that all the 12 stones gathered together and formed one stone. and that talks about the unification of the Jewish people, even though there were 12 tribes, but there was a unity that was created. But then we're going to go where it says, and he dreamt, and behold, a ladder was set earthward, and its top reached heavenward. And behold, angels of God were ascending and descending on it. So this ladder is something very significant for us. In addition to the fact, you say it's significant enough just the fact that they're angels, because most of us haven't probably encountered a ladder with angels on it. At least not I haven't, I should say. So what was the nature of this ladder? So one thing we learned from the commentary is that the ladder, I always pictured kind of like a ladder, how you have a ladder that you lean against your roof or something like that, and that it was, you just kind of had this ladder going up. This ladder was specifically, it said it had three legs to this ladder. It wasn't a two-legged lean against ladder, and it wasn't the ladder like with a four post legs. It had three legs. It was a ladder with three legs. And there's a significance of that because if you remember some ideas from Pirkei Avot, from the Ethics of the Father, we have a number of statements that say the world stands on three things. Okay? So the world stands on three things. And that what Yaakov was having was not just like, wow, this is so floaty. I'm seeing like these angels going up and down the ladder. This was a learning experience for him. His dream was a learning experience that he was having that was instructing him about something that he needed to know before he goes on with his life. Because we don't really record dreams like, oh, you should have heard what I dreamt last night. This was couldn't have been the first dream he ever had. It might have been an exciting dream, but it wasn't the first dream. So why record a dream? Why do we need to know that he was dreaming about a ladder unless it's for our instruction? So we're taught that this ladder had three legs, and it stands for what we're taught that the world stands on three things. The world stands on, and the Pirkei Avot says, Al HaTorah, on Torah, Al HaTorah, Avodah, and on service to God, meaning either the sacrificial system or prayer, because the prayers took the place of sacrifices, the Al-Gmilut Chasadim, and acts of loving kindness. That the world not only stands on these things that it needs it to continue functioning, but the world was created with those things embedded in it, and we have an ongoing obligation to continue with those three things because that's what upholds the world. Those three things are actually connected to each of the patriarchs as well. And we can kind of figure out what the assignment might be of each one. So we'll start with Gemilut Chasadim, acts of loving kindness. Which patriarch is that going to be?
Abraham,
who is known for Chesed. And then we have the Avodah, which is sacrifice. So who is known about sacrifice?
Isaac.
And Al HaTorah, it said the Torah is Yaakov. That Yaakov is considered to be the embodiment of Torah because when he is first described, he is called an Ish Tam Yoshev Ba'ohalim, that he is a pure-minded person who sits in the tent, in the tent of learning. He was the essence of Torah study. So we have then that this ladder represents also the three pillars, and that he learns that he is not just grandson of the patriarch Abraham, that he learns also what his role is in the creation of the Jewish people of being the third pillar. And that is instructive to us as well as to him, for him to know that he is the representation that the Jewish people is standing on him. Now this is an odd time for him to find this out, because he's in a state of considerable vulnerability. His brother wants to kill him. He is on his own. He's going to a place where the family are idol worshippers and swindlers and thieves and cheats and everything else. And he's kind of out with nothing. The Midrash tells us he has not a penny to his name, that once Yaakov fled, that Esav sent his son Eliphaz after Yaakov to kill him. And that Eliphaz, because he was raised in the house of Abraham and Isaac, could not bring himself to kill his uncle Yaakov, but he was under command by his father to kill Jacob. And Jacob said, take all my money. Having no money is as good as dead, and tell your father I'm no longer alive. Okay, so it's like, okay, he took all of his money, so that when Yaakov comes to Laban's house, he has nothing. That's why he ends up having to work in order to marry Rachel and Leah, as it turns out, is he's not like Eliezer was when Eliezer comes to the same household with money and jewelry and gold and bracelets and camels and all this stuff. It's like, Yaakov comes by himself. That's not the way his parents sent him off. They didn't say, goodbye, go flee. They sent him with a lot, but he ends up basically being robbed of it all by Esau's son. So he has nothing. So it's an interesting time when you've been stripped of your family connection. You can no longer be in your family. Your brother wants to kill you. You've been robbed. You have nothing. You're out in the middle of nowhere. You're putting stones around you to guard you from wild beasts that might attack you. And then you have this dream that says, and you are the third pillar of the Jewish people. It's like, seriously? That doesn't sound like it goes together. So we find about Yaakov that he is the person who encounters God's presence and reality, specifically in times when he is the most vulnerable, and that is the nature of his life. Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sacks had a beautiful Devar Torah about this on the age.com website. Do you see it? Oh, it's so beautiful. I'm like, that's already what I was going to talk about. So he and I were thinking like this. So Yaakov has this ability to encounter God and be presented, and because he's open. And in a dream state, we know that we are more open, right? Because you let down your defenses and you're dreaming, and this is a time of instruction. And he is able to take this in, and he develops a resiliency in him, which is really what symbolizes who Yaakov is, and that will become later who the Jewish people are. That we are not called B'nai Avraham, we are not called the children of Avraham, we are not called B'nai Yitzchak, the children of Isaac, we are called B'nai Yisrael, which is Yaakov's name when it is changed to Israel, and we're called Beit Yaakov, the house of Jacob, the children of Israel. Yaakov and Yisrael being the same. So we have this quality has been embedded in us, just like the qualities of Abraham have been embedded in us, and the qualities of Isaac have been embedded in us, but the quality of Yaakov is what makes the whole thing work. So even though there are three pillars, it says that they're not all exactly equal, that Torah is the one that is making the other ones work. So there can be a main leg, and then there can be supporting legs. So even though Yaakov is the third of the patriarchs, you'd think he would be the tertiary in importance, and that Avraham would be the mainstay, and that the acts of loving kindness would be the mainstay, and then you would certainly think the sacrifices and prayer, that would be the mainstay, and Torah study, kind of like when you have time. So that's the opposite. Torah is the mainstay, and the other two are the support for it. It says Yaakov is considered the pinnacle of the three patriarchs, that he's considered the most beloved of the three patriarchs, more so than Avraham and more so than Yitzhak. Now, we're not saying that God didn't like Avraham and Yitzhak. We're just saying that that there is a gradation, and that Yaakov is the one that is the most preferred. He's called the choicest. So it doesn't mean the others aren't good. It just means that he's considered the choicest of the patriarchs. So, thoughts or comments on this so far? Jenna?
Is that because he combined basically the chesed and the gevurah?
Very good. So exactly what Jenna is saying, the chesed of Abraham and the gevurah of Yitzchak, they represented those things in complete essence. And Yaakov is able to, he represents tiferet, which means harmony or beauty. And the harmony or beauty is an ability to come to a synthesis that is on a whole other level. And Yaakov reaches that. So he combines both of those qualities, which is really, that's his one of his gifts. Good morning. So that's part of what Yaakov is going to learn. So he sees this ladder. And interestingly, what's happening on this ladder is it says that, behold, angels of God were ascending and descending on it. So normally it said it's not really very good manners that if you have angels that are watching you and then they're going to be a changing of the guard, you would usually normally do, it says the way the pillar of cloud and the pillar of fire worked in the desert when the Jewish people were wandering, how should that really go? It says it wasn't just at night that excuse me, the pillar of fire, and then in the morning it went away and then the cloud came. It's just like a good changing of the guard. The pillar of fire stayed until the cloud came, and then, changing of the guard. You don't just abandon. But here, it looks like it says the angels of God were ascending, leaving Jacob, and then others came down, and the first ones didn't wait for the other ones to come. Excuse me. So that's not very good derech eretz. That's not very good manners for angels. So how did they do this? Why did it happen? So it says the reason it happened is that the next line, in verse 13, and let's read verse 13 there. Let's see. Hetty, would you like to read verse 13?
And behold, Hashem was standing over him, and he said, I am Hashem, God of Abraham, your father, and God of Isaac, the ground upon which you are lying. To you will I give it, and to your descendants.
Okay, and then he goes on with the whole blessing, which is the blessing of Abraham and Yitzhak. But it says God was standing over him. So we say, since God was there, what role are the angels playing? We don't really need the angels right then. Since the angels can leave, because who needs angels when you have God right there? God was standing over him. God was the source of his protection. He didn't need any angels. So we actually learn from this about a song that we sing on Friday night. When we say Shalom Aleichem to the angels, and we have all the verses, Shalom Aleichem, welcome angels, and we say Boachem L'Shalom, you know, come on in, Barchuni, bless us, and then we say, like not very good hosts, we say, bye, Seitzchem L'Shalom. Go in peace, we don't need you anymore. So since when do we not need the protecting force of angels? I mean, we're always under the protection of God, but we use angels as the messengers. It says once Shabbos comes, Shabbos is the equivalent of what Yaakov experienced here. Is God, the divine presence, the Shekhinah, God is in your home. You don't need any angels. So we say goodbye to the angels. We don't need you. Now God is on duty directly over me. Even again, we're holding in mind our paradox. God is always on duty over us all the time, but uses messengers, uses malachim, uses angels as agents. But on Shabbos, there's no need for that because God's presence is directly experienced in our home. So we say goodbye to the angels. It says this comes from here. We say we don't need the angels because God's presence is standing right there. When we go back to the ladder that Yaakov sees, we want to look at the spelling of the word for the ladder. And in Hebrew, if you go on the Hebrew side in the third line, and you can either say the last word of the sentence or the first word on the left, which is the word sulam. Okay, the word sulam means a ladder. So interestingly though, this spelling of sulam is not how you spell sulam. If you want to spell ladder, if you look up in a Hebrew dictionary for the word ladder, you'll find sulam, but it'll be spelled with four letters, not three. So it's Samach, Vav, Lamed, Mem. So the U, the Vav makes can be used as a vowel sound. That's Sulam. Here it doesn't use it. It's called a defective spelling or an alternative spelling. But both spellings have meaning. So the meaning of the spelling, if it was spelled fully, Sulam, gives us a gematria of 136. So you can write it out. The Samach, which is equal to 60. The Vav is equal to 6. The Lamed is equal to 30, and Mem is equal to 40. So that gives us a total of 136. This 136, you say, like, oh, anything exciting about this number, 136? Everyone goes, well, the 36 part is good. That's a double high. But the number 136 actually has significance for us, and it harkens back to when we were during the high holidays. And on Yom Kippur, when we talk about, actually it's on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, when we talk about the Unatana Tokef, is when we talk about the decrees that will come to us in the coming year, we have a phrase that we say, Uteshuva, Utefila, Utsadaka. So Teshuva is repentance or return, Tefila is prayer, and Tzedaka is giving Tzedaka. Ma'avir et Roach HaGezerah. They will annul the harshness of the decrees that might be in store for us. They change reality. Those things change reality. If you go back to your machzer, if you have a traditional machzer, and you look above each of those words, the word of Teshuvah, Tefillah, and Tzedakah, you will see in parentheses, small print, another word above each of those words. Okay, so above the word Teshuvah, you will see the word Tzom, which means fasting, to fast. Okay, fasting. Above the word Tefillah, prayer, you'll see the word Kol, which means voice, that we pray with a voice out loud. And above the word Tzedakah, you'll see the word Mamon, which means sounds pretty much like what it is, money. Okay, the word Mamon means money. Those words are the words that are above in like a small superscript above each of those words. So when you go home, check your machzer. Again, if you have a traditional machzer, It'll have that. It's not some newfangled thing. That's what they have. Each of those words, kol, meaning voice, som, meaning fasting, and mamon, each individually, they're each equal to 136. Okay, each of those equals 136. It says, this is the sulam. This is the ladder to change our reality. So this is what we say, that this changes the decree. This changes the harshness of the decree. There may still be something that needs to happen that's going to feel negative to us, painful, harsh, but it changes it and makes it, it sweetens it. It makes it better. It changes reality. This is our ladder of growth and how to access the ladder. So when you see a ladder, what would be your instinct of like what we should do with it? It's like, get on it. Don't say, oh yeah, there's a ladder. It's like, so climb it. It says, what, where's our sulam? So you can stand at the bottom and say, well yeah, there's the ladder. And it goes, oh, it goes all the way, because it says, how far does it go up? That it says that it goes heavenward, okay? Hashamayma. It's going towards heaven, towards the Kisei HaKavo, towards the throne of glory. And this path is what gets us there. It says, if you want to access it, this sulam, so it wasn't a typo in the, okay, we're going to get back to why the other spelling of sulam the way it is here. So we have a hint to this idea that through teshuva, tefillah, and tzedakah, those are the paths to changing our life. And that Yaakov is learning this as well by being presented with the physical form of this numerical equivalent of 136. You could say, if you know the joke that people are in a, my father used to tell this joke, Allah shalom, that the prisoners who were in kind of isolation, that they had a joke book that they would pass around and it had numbers on it, like joke 3, joke 5, joke 10. And so then they would just bang like this for like which joke they were talking about, and then everyone would start to laugh. And then one person did it and no one laughed. And they're like, you just don't know how to tell a joke.
Yeah.
Okay. So I always love that. That was really funny. Now that's a good joke. And I told it, which is really crazy because I don't tell jokes. So anyway, my father used to always tell that joke. He told it really well. Anyway, so Yaakov, if he could have a dream that was supposed to be instructive, if God just said to him, the key is 136. He was like, okay, what does that mean? So, but you're being presented with a visual image that encapsulates the concept of these 136s that equal all of these things together as a package deal of this is going to be your path, this is going to be the path of the Jewish people, and this is the secret. I'm giving you this in a dream, I'm giving you this insight, the path of the sulam, the path of the ladder, the spiritual ladder, is through teshuvah, tefillah, and tzedakah. And same thing for us, that when we want to change, when we want to grow spiritually, it's through teshuvah, correcting our actions and getting back on track, through tefillah of praying for help with the change that we want to make, and through tzedakah of extending ourselves and having the merit of giving money to other people who are in need. So that's the path. So I'm giving you this as a gift, this sulam. Now, what about the sulam? So then, if that's true, why doesn't it, the Torah spell sulam in the complete way and include the vav? And instead it doesn't. It leaves the vav out. Okay, it leaves the vav out, and instead we just have samach, lamed, mem. All of these insights are from the Baal HaTurim and heard from by me by Rabbi Abba Wagensberg, in addition to seeing it from the Baal HaTurim. So the way it's written there, sulam without the vav, also has a numerical equivalent. And the numerical equivalent, bless you, is going to be the same except minus the 6 of the vav. So if you have 136 minus 6 equals 130. So what does that equal? Bless you. Sorry, I didn't mean to pass the cough to you. It says this is equal, this is the gematria of a phrase, ze kisei hakavod. This is the throne of glory. It says what is this ladder? This is the throne of glory, meaning the essence of being able to access God's presence. So Zeh, I can spell it out for you. Zeh is Zion Hey. Kisei is Chaf Samach Aleph. And Hakavod is Hey Chaf Vav. I'm sorry, Bet Vav Dalid. And that will equal 130. Zeh Kisei Hakavod. This is the throne of glory. He says, what is Yaakov seeing? He says, I'm seeing the throne of glory. I'm seeing as close as a person can get to God. So how is it that when someone is stripped of everything, they have the potential to see everything. Because a lot of times physical things get in our way and keep us from seeing the spiritual opportunities that are hovering right around us. And then right in that next verse, then he says, and behold. So anytime it says, and behold, this isn't just like Shakespeare. Behold, hark, I hear his voice. This is behold of like, wow, I wasn't expecting this. It means there's an element of surprise. And like, I didn't realize this was here. I wasn't looking for anything. And now I see that there's something here. So then God speaks to Yaakov and gives him the blessing. I will guard you. I'll return you to the soil. I will not forsake you until I will have done what I have spoken about you. And then we go on to the next page, on page 147. So it says in verse 16, and Susie, would you like to read for us there?
Sure. Jacob awoke from his sleep and said, surely Hashem is present in this place, and I did not know. And he became frightened, and he said, how awesome is this place? This is none other than the abode of God, and this is the gate of heavens.
Okay, great. Thank you. So this is considered the place where he was sleeping is the future site of the Beit HaMikdash, the future site of the Holy Temple. And he comes across it. It had its holiness before the temple was built there. It wasn't the temple was built there, and so it became a holy place. It was already a holy place, and that's why the temple was built there. And Yaakov recognizes this place. This was also the same place. This is on Har HaMoriah. This is also the same place of the Akedah when Isaac was also bound, and the same place that Abraham called Beit El, the house of God. So all of the patriarchs have come across this, but Yaakov didn't know where he was. He didn't realize that he was in a place of tremendous spiritual connection.
So this is not Beit El as far as the town of Israel?
I don't believe, no. Uh-huh. No, because it's Yerushalayim.
Okay.
That's the Beit El. Really, really close. Okay. So it's interesting when it says here in the Hebrew, Vayikat Yaakov Mishnato in the Hebrew, from his sleeping, awoke from his sleep. So that word, basically Mishnato, you might recognize the word from the word Mishnah. Okay? Mishnah doesn't mean the sleep book. Okay? The Mishnah is study, Torah study. And to word, when we say a Mishnah Torah, it means to review, from the word shnayim, to go over something again, to repeat. So there's something, it says that when he ended Yaakov Mishnato from his review, from his learning, that it was a sleep, but it wasn't just a kind of sleep. It was a sleeping, and it was a learning, it was a revelation to him. Diane.
You know, there have been psychological studies that when we learn, we imprint when we sleep. That it's in sleep that you can really learn something.
I have heard that, and I've heard that with, I went to, my husband and I were at a conference, and a sleep specialist was the keynote speaker, and no one fell asleep, which was also good. But he talked about the profound whole thing that happens during sleep, and that he was advising people, someone who was an Olympic wannabe champion, for help of what to do, and he said, go to sleep, get more sleep. That is, in your sleep, your body is going to rehearse, and you will get more out of sleeping than anything. And then they came in like first place or second place and sent him the picture of like with the prize. But that's where it goes in, which is why it says if you have it the night before a test, don't stay up and cram. Go to sleep, and that's where it goes in. So learning has that. And of course with Yaakov, and we still say, and the Talmud says that sleep is 1/40th prophecy for all of us. Of course there's 39 other parts of Narishkeit, so you can't necessarily rely on it. Okay, so we don't know. But in Yaakov's case, this sleep was a revelation to him. This was teaching him. This was a teachable moment. And he wakes up from this, or he ends this review, he ends this study, and he says, whoa, achein, yesh Hashem b'makom hazeh. And it says, surely, achein, that God is in this place. And then he says, v'anochi lo yadati. So we're going to dissect this sentence here a little bit, looking into it in more depth. So, according to the Midrash, it says that Yaakov, after he fled from his parents' house, he did not go straight to his uncle Laban's house. He goes first to what's called the Yeshiva of Shem and Aver for 14 years. that he's studying and learning what's called the Torah of exile, meaning what aspects of Torah do you have to be more knowledgeable about if you're going to be in exile, because that's where he was going, is into exile. And that while he was learning there, he learned all the what's called the revealed Torah as well as the hidden mystical aspects. He learned everything. But there was one thing he didn't learn. So it says here, Achein Yesh Hashem, Bayomir Achein. This word Achein is understood to be a reference to what is called the Kisei HaKavod, the throne of glory, throne of honor, throne of glory, God's throne of glory, which is described by the prophet Ezekiel. Now, if you've ever read the prophet Ezekiel, it's pretty far out there. The rabbis almost, yeah, but you'd say, people would say, what was he on? It was so mystical. It's just so much. It's hard to understand. The allegories he uses, the metaphors he uses, if you didn't know what he was talking about, you would have no idea what he's talking about. I don't know what he's talking about.
So many of the words in Ezekiel have been brought into modern Hebrew, like Hashmal.
Hashmal, yeah.
Like Merkabah.
Yeah.
I mean,
Hashmal is the electrical.
It's pretty soft.
And the Merkabah is a chariot.
Ezekiel?
So,
no. Ezekiel is holding.
It's Yeheskel. Hizkiyahu is Hezekiah.
Okay.
Merkabah is in modern Hebrew.
It's a tank.
A tank in the military.
Well,
Merkabah in Ezekiel is a chariot. In modern Hebrew, it's a chariot, but the Merkabah in the army is the tank. You're in the Merkabah. That's what you are. My nephews are in the Merkabah. So, and they're not in any fiery chariots of Ezekiel, I can tell you that. Okay, so Ezekiel, in that, describes the Kisei HaKavod, the throne of glory, and other mystical ideas. And in it, it describes that on four sides that there are four different faces. Actually, there's a change, because it says after the sin of the golden calf, it changed. So I'm just going to say that up front. That the word Achein, which is spelled Aleph Chaf Nun, you can see it, it's in the second line of the Hebrew, the first word on the right. You can look at that letter, that word. The Aleph, it says that this is for the word Aryeh. And Aryeh is a lion. Good. And the Chaf is for a kruv, which sounds kind of like the English word, is the cherub. Okay, the kruv is the cherub, the kruvim, like that was on top of the ark inside the Mishkan. And the Nun is for a Nesher. A Nesher, which also has a name, and it's a like a van service in Israel. But a Nesher is an eagle. Okay? So it says that those faces are on the Kisei HaKavod. So he's saying, Vayomer, and Yaakov is saying, Achein Yesh Hashem. I knew about, and I learned from Shem and Ever in their yeshiva, that the Kisei HaKavod has on it the face of a lion, the face of a cherub, and the face of an eagle. But he says, after there, Va'anochi, three words down, Lo Yadati. But it says, Va'anochi, I didn't know. It says, what does that mean? Va'anochi, Lo Yadati. But I didn't know. Okay, so he's saying, look at the word Va'anochi. So if you go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, the sixth word in, Va'anochi. The same letters as the word Achein. The V just means and. So if you put your finger over the Vav, and you have Anochi, Aleph, Nun, Chaf, Yud. Those are the exact same letters as Achein. Aleph, Chaf, Nun. There's one letter that's added, and that's a Yud. So the Yud is Yaakov. What didn't Yaakov know? He didn't know. He never saw, and he was never told in his learning that who's the fourth face on the throne of glory, of God's throne of glory? His. Now, can you imagine that? It's like, I didn't know it was me. I'm the fourth face on that. Not the face of Isaac, not the face of Abraham, not the face of Joseph, not the face of Moshe, not the face of King David. Yaakov's face is up there. That's what he didn't know. That I didn't know. Anochi lo yadati. I did not know that I was the fourth piece on that Kisei HaKavod.
But why does he deserve all that kavod?
Yaakov,
yeah.
He is considered the epitome of all the patriarchs. He is considered, he stands for Torah, and Torah is supreme. So all of us here learning Torah, this is all learning Torah. It says this is what's really holding up the world. This is what's holding up the ladder. This is Yaakov's face on the Kisei HaKavod. That's what's making everything else happen. It looks like other things are making things happen, and other things are involved, but this is what's really making everything happen. Yaakov represents that. So Yaakov, the Torah study, learning Torah, who Yaakov is, integration of the Chesed and the Tiferet into this new place, the synthesis that's called this harmony and this beauty, that's what makes him worthy to be our patriarch who we call ourselves after. So that's Yaakov, the B'nai Yisrael, Beit Yaakov, the children of Jacob, the house of Jacob, the children of Israel, that's us. So this is what he is talking about here, and what's really going on with this ladder is he has been being given this incredible mystical experience, but with very practical application, because it's telling him how things work and what he's supposed to do and what his mission is in his life, is to carry this forward, which is why we need to know it. Otherwise, you could just write it off and say, wow, you should have heard the dream I had last night, and just leave it at that. It doesn't need to be something that's preserved for thousands of years so that we know it as well. So that's Yaakov's experience with the ladder. And he says here, how awesome is this place? And this is none other than the abode of God, and this is the gate of the heavens. And he's identifying it that that's how we understand the Beit HaMikdash, the Holy Temple in Yerushalayim, that is considered like the entry point, the nexus point of the spiritual and physical world, the closest place we can come, and that's where Yaakov was, and he gets a full amount, download of information about what that is for him to then pass on to his family and to his descendants and to all of us. And here we are, 3,000 years later, sitting and reading, it's like, oh, that's who we are. So Yaakov's face is up on that Kisei HaKavod. I can't even imagine. And you can see you would become a little, you would be excited, but you would be a little alarmed and overwhelmed if you saw that God's throne was resting on, depending on your face. Mm-hmm. Like, what if you saw that? What if you looked up and you saw God's throne of glory and there's Hedy Gurentz right there? Like, you're the, you'd be like,
they were in trouble.
we would feel a sense of responsibility, right? We would feel a sense of responsibility that there would be something, we have an obligation. We have a very big honor and a big obligation. So it's interesting because the word kavod, which means honor, is related to the word kaved, which means heavy. Okay, so honor is a responsibility. It's not like, oh, my face is up there and yours isn't. It's like, oh my gosh, my face is up there. The world's depending on me. It's a big responsibility. And so Yaakov was given that.
So what strikes me is that, you know, when we talk about Moses and God has so much, at least, from, you know, more relationship, more time with, more, he gave Moses the Torah, uh-huh. You know, and so it's kind of interesting that Moses isn't on that face.
I hear you. I'd say, that's, I could say, Jacob's like, I wasn't expecting me up there. Yeah. Right. So Yaakov is the pillar of that. So Moshe is pillar of other things. Moshe is the pillar in the Sefirot of Netzach, of endurance, of eternality. So he brings that, and he's called Moshe Rabbeinu, Moshe our teacher, Moshe the most humble person who ever lived. Yaakov is called the man of truth and the man of harmony and beauty. So each, they all have different qualities that don't negate one another, but they're different aspects. So this is Yaakov's portion here. Cindy, do you have a question? Okay. All right, so this is Yaakov, and he needs to know this before he goes and forms his family, so that he can't see himself as just man on the run and going to find a wife, that he needs to know what his destiny is. And I think that that idea of destiny versus fate is very important. Esau saw his life as one of just fate. You know, what's going to happen to me? I'm just going to, you know, eat and drink and make merry for tomorrow you die. You know, that kind of idea versus seizing your destiny. But if you don't know what your destiny is, it's hard to seize it. So Yaakov is really being given this as a gift, along with God's promise that he's going to take care of him. And then with that, then Yaakov proceeds, and it says he lifted his feet at the beginning of verse 29, which means that the way kind of shortened for him so that he could get there sooner. And then he comes across already, and he's going to meet up with Rachel at the well. So let's take a look at that as well. We're going to look at that. We're looking on page 149. Yes. Okay, and then we see, we're going to go, so he meets Rachel, and when she comes to him, picking up in verse 11. And Kay, would you like to read verse 11 for us?
Then Jacob kissed Rachel, and he raised his voice and wept. Jacob told Rachel that he was her father's relative and that he was Rebekah's son. Then she ran and told her father.
Okay, we're going to focus on, then Jacob kissed Rachel and he raised his voice and wept. So according to the commentary, and then there is a beautiful description again on the Aish website by Rabbi David Foreman. And it's a 10-minute video that talks about the weeping of Yaakov. He raised his voice and wept, and connects it to the raising his voice and weeping of Esau in last week's Parsha, which I love Rabbi Foreman because he takes the most obvious connection that you never thought of, or like that I never thought of, and then explains it.
So it's anguish. This is love.
This is anguish.
This is anguish.
This is anguish. He raised his voice and wept. This is anguish. It's anguish. So in the commentary, it says that the anguish is, Diane,
where is this video?
Video is on the aish.com website, and it's, you look under, it's this week for Parsha Vayetzeh, and it's Rabbi David Foreman, F-O-H-R-M-A-N, and it's a 10-minute video, and it's animated and everything. It's not a picture of him, it's a picture of the story, and he narrates it, and it's a beautiful explanation. And he leaves you hanging. It's a cliffhanger for next week when it's resolved. But he does it. So this is a voice. This is anguish. He kisses her, but he is in anguish over this. And the two, you can read in the commentary, which we're going to talk about, but from a slightly different perspective, says that he wept because he foresaw with divine inspiration that he was not going to be buried with her in the Ma'arat HaMachpelah, in the cave of Machpelah. That he was not going to be buried with her. He would not get to be with her. Then the other is that he also wept because he had nothing to give her. And that what we mentioned before, that he comes as a pauper, as a penniless, he has nothing. He barely has the shirt on his back. He has nothing to offer and not the gifts, and he just felt so bad about that. So on one hand, you say, well, okay, so you feel bad, but you don't have to, like, come unglued over that. But that it was such a source of sadness for him. But the other, more important, that he was not going to be buried with her, that he saw that. Susan. Yes.
It does.
Because you are married to your spouse, unless you have a get, which dissolves that relationship in this world and the next world, you are with your husband for eternity. You remain married to them forever. Which is why it's a tradition that if a woman remarries after the death of a first husband, that she is buried with her first husband.
Really?
Not with her.
But aren't
the first husband?
I'm sorry?
Yeah. So what if the woman dies and the man remarries within a month or a year, whatever they tell the man to get married again? Does he get buried with his first wife?
So that's who you are connected to. Wow. Now, there's halachic things. I can't answer any other questions. That's something you should look into. Ask your local Orthodox rabbi about this. So we're just going to talk about it, not in the realm of this, but in the realm of what is the significance of being buried there. So we have to go back to where are the matriarchs and patriarchs buried? It's called the Ma'arat HaMachpelah. It comes from the word, Ma'arat means the cave of, Machpelah comes from the word kafal, which means a couple. Do you hear how that sounds like the English word couple?
Couple.
Kaful means to double up. It means a couple.
It comes from kaful.
Yeah.
Oh, interesting.
Okay, Ma'arat HaMachpelah is the doubling up. says, there's so many things you could have called the Ma'arata Machpelah. I mean, given the fact that Adam and Eve are buried there, you could have called it Ma'arata Adam HaRishon, the cave of Adam and Eve, or the cave of creation. It's also considered the entry point to the Gan Eden, to the world to come. You could have called it Ma'arata Gan Eden. It's like a lot of other things you could have called it. You're calling it the cave of the couples? It's not so uncommon in a cemetery to have couples buried. So, like, what's so significant? Why are you calling it the cave of the couples? It says, because the coupling of those people who are buried with each other represents their eternal bond to one another. They are eternally connected. So some people think, like, oh, you know, maybe, okay, I could be married to him for this long, but, you know, I'm not sure how much longer I could take it. It's like, better work on that relationship, because you are with that person for eternity, because you are the same soul. Because what's our understanding? Our understanding of marriage is you were the same soul, God split you in this world, and you came back together again, which is your true form in this world. And so that is who you are. So you're going to be, it is in our best interests to make that relationship as wonderful as possible, because that's who we're spending eternity with. It's not like, okay, just for this lifetime, and then I'm going to float around. Again, we have this idea, I'm going to float around in eternity just kind of on my own. No one's going to bother me, and I'm just going to be enjoying, you know, bliss or something. You will be enjoying bliss with your partner, with your husband. So make it good. So this is that he was upset that he was not going to be with Rachel for this, that they would not be. Have that coupling in that same way. This goes on to say, is who is he going to be really with for eternity? Leah. So it says, this is the coupling. We talked about, when we talked about Abraham and Sarah, when it says at the end of Chaye Sarah, and he took an additional wife, Sarah had already died. What do you mean an additional wife? Wasn't he no longer married? It's like, yes, he is still, spiritually, he is still married to Sarah. And that is who he's with. So he doesn't get buried with his second wife. He gets buried with Sarah. That's the couple. And Isaac and Rebekah, that's the couple. And Yaakov, who does he want to be buried with? He wants to be buried with Rachel, but he's going to be buried with Leah. And that brings him sadness.
It says later on that he was deceived into marrying
right?
Leah first.
He was. He did marry Leah first,
but
and it stands.
If he foresaw that...
He foresaw that, but he didn't foresee exactly how it was going to happen. Okay. So it said that he had a plan. He did have a plan. This we have talked about before, but I think it's so fascinating, we're going to review it. His plan was, originally, Jacob and Esau, who were brothers, were destined to marry Rachel and Leah. That would have been just perfect. Okay? So... Yaakov, who was the younger, was to be married to Rachel, who was the younger, and Esau, the older, was going to be married to Leah, the older. Because Esau was wicked, Leah prayed and davened. It says that's why her eyes were tender, that she cried and prayed so hard that she not be married to Esau. So she gets her prayers are answered. And because Esau sold his birthright, remember he sold it for the lentil stew? That's how much he said, I despise it, I don't want it. Because he did that, Yaakov becomes the embodiment, really, of the mission of both Esav and Yaakov. The twins that they were in the womb, he becomes the embodiment of both. Susan?
Isn't he married to Rachel and Leah?
He is, so that's going to be a problem. I'll tell you what plan A was going to be. There was a plan A. So that's what he sees is not going to happen. His plan is not going to happen. And Laban messes up the plan for eternity. So that was going to be the goal originally, Jacob and Esau, Leah and Rachel, paired up older, older, younger, younger. So because of Leah's prayers that she not marry somebody who's wicked, and Esau, as a demonstration of his wickedness, wants no part of his spiritual inheritance anyway, he doesn't want to have that, Yaakov takes on both. He becomes basically like two people, which is interesting because he later has two names. He's both Yaakov and Yisrael. Not like Avraham, who was Avram and became Avraham, and we don't ever call him Avram again. Yaakov and Yisrael, we go back and forth and call him both. To this day, we call him both. He has kind of two identities. That means he really is destined in this way. He needs to marry both Rachel and Leah. But there's a problem. In the future, there's going to be a law of Torah that says that a man cannot be married to two women who are sisters in their lifetimes.
Right.
Okay? You can marry consecutively. You can marry a woman, and then if she passes away, you could marry her sister, but not in their lifetimes. So what happens? Is Yaakov's plan is plan A, that he will marry Rachel first. He knows by this that she's going to die young, that she will die in childbirth, that he won't have her, and then he will marry Leah, and he will marry both, and it'll be totally kosher and okay, and he'll be buried with both of them in the cave of Machpelah, because in his case, it's not a twosome couple, it's really a threesome, because he represents the fourth person. It really should have been Esav being buried in Machpelah with Leah, but instead it's going to be Yaakov with Rachel and Leah. But because of the way it happened, and Laban is the one who uproots this by his deception, Yaakov, it can't happen, and he can't do it because Leah lives to a ripe old age, and Rachel dies young, and it doesn't work. So on Pesach, when we say the Aramean who tried to destroy my father's house, that's what we're talking about. Is Laban tried to mess up what Jacob needed to do in order to fulfill his complete destiny. So he ended up with plan B. Okay, he ended up with plan B. But as we know, God has lots of plans. Plan B, plan C, plan D, and whatever it is, you just keep going.
Well,
this again,
very specifically on the road, there was a specific reason why she was there.
And God has lots of reasons for doing what he does. And there is a reason, and we talked about one year, a whole explanation of why Rachel had to be on the road. For not even that reason, but because of who Rachel was and her love of the Jewish people, that she's called the mother of the Jewish people. How is she the mother of the Jewish people? She only had 2 out of the 12. What makes her the mother of the Jewish people? By definition, she's not. Leah is really the mother of the Jewish people. So there's a whole understanding about that as well. So God works in layers. God doesn't do cartoon life, you know, we're just like a little stick figure. This is reality. Reality has many, many layers. So it all works out. That's why we don't have to be worried. It's like, oh, if I don't do this exactly the right thing, then it's going to ruin everything. It's like, don't worry. God has lots of ways of making things work out, and a lot of things are going on simultaneously that we can't even begin to appreciate. What Yaakov sees here and when he weeps is, this is not going to be what I wanted. This is not going to be the way I was hoping it was going to be. It's going to be something else, and he weeps for that. That's not going to happen. So Rachel and Leah then represent and some say that they were twins also, just like Jacob and Esau, that kind of older and younger, just like by a few moments, that they represent a twinning of their characteristics as well, and it all goes into Jacob to fulfill with them. So just like a pregnancy is one birth, a twin pregnancy is a birth of one birth with two, that Jacob and Esau become that same thing. Jacob becomes the epitome of both of them and has then the job of both of them, because Esau's role was supposed to be the one who was outside in the physical world dealing with all of the challenges of materialism and physicality and subduing that. Yaakov was supposed to be Yoshev Ohalim. He was supposed to be the Torah scholar. What does his life end up being? He's outside with the sheep. Okay, he ends up being a shepherd, and he's outside with physicality. He's the one who's dealing with idol worshippers and connivers and cheaters. How did he get this dual role? He gets this dual role because he got the birthright for the whole kit and caboodle, basically. And so this changes, and when he sees Rachel, and he sees that this is what's going to happen, this is what causes him to weep, is it's not going to be as I wished it. Patricia.
Isn't Esau's head in the cave?
Esau's head is in the cave of Machpelah.
So how do you reconcile that with the coupling?
So that's the only part of him that merited to be in there. Again, if Esau would have behaved and done what he was supposed to do, and he would have married Leah, they would have been the next couple in there.
But why does his head even get in there?
His head gets in there because he gave honor to his father. Says because he knew Torah, he didn't practice it. There was a disconnect.
Where's his body?
We won't even describe what happened to his body. It is not, it was taken care of in a different way, I don't even know. But his head merited to, it said it rolled in. It rolled into the cave of Machpelah, and that's what's there is his head. Because that's the only part that merited. It says God's justice is fair. it's not like, oh, well, you were 99% bad, so we'll just consider round up to the nearest 100 and you're bad. It's like, no, your head was, you knew Torah. You knew Torah. That you chose not to ever live it, I'm really sorry, but we'll reward the part of you that did the right thing, which is you learned it, so your head can go in. That's the only part that can go in. The rest of it does not go in. Okay?
The fact that the plan got changed, mm-hmm. and Jacob ends up being a shepherd instead of what he was thought he was, you know, isn't that then again another lesson for us that, you know, we can have Torah and be in the outside world? We can bring, because...
Yes,
Jacob
is, so when we said at the beginning that Jacob's spiritual growth is encountered, and as Rabbi Laura Jonathan Sacks describes, what Jacob represents is the ability to lead and have spiritual growth in the very times of crisis and challenge that most of us would say, oh, if I wasn't a shepherd, then I would learn Torah. He learns Torah, observes commandments while he's a shepherd. So later, when he meets up with Esav in next week's Parsha, and it says, Im Lavan Garti, it says, with Laban I lived, it says that the word Garti, that the numerical equivalent of that is 613. It's the Taryag Mitzvot, the Tav Resh Yud Gimel Mitzvot, 613 commandments. That the 613 commandments is that he said, I was living with Laban, and even though I was surrounded by somebody who was tricking me and changing my wages and oppressing me and treating me so poorly, and his shepherds were treating me, even with all that, lots of excuses on why you shouldn't have to measure up to anything. He says, Im Garti, Im Lavan Garti, with Laban, I observed the 613 mitzvot. In spite of that. Mm-hmm. In fact, maybe not even in spite of it, but the challenge itself brought out a certain resilience and ability to be able to come back and to be even stronger. So he's the strongest. It's not just like, and I just barely schlepped it out of me. It's like, I prevailed. And what does Yisrael mean? Yisrael means I struggled and I prevailed. That's where he's given the name when he wrestles with the angel. It's about prevailing during the time of challenge. Because when does he wrestle with the angel of Esau? Is when he's on the way to meet Esau. Again, when he's vulnerable. My brother, I know he plans to kill me. He's sending 400 men. It looks like maybe he's still planning to kill me. What am I supposed to do? He was vulnerable, and now he has his wives and his children and all of his wealth. Now what's he supposed to do? And again, right at that moment, we're like, what am I supposed to do? I'm totally vulnerable. That's when he has the wrestling with the angel, and he gets his name changed and another upgrade to his spiritual greatness. It says, we all keep thinking, if only my life was easier, then I could be more spiritual. If only I didn't have all these things to do, and if everything was just going right, then I could grow. It's like, no, you won't. And Jacob is the method of teaching us that is the growth is coming exactly at the moments when we are being challenged. That's when it's happening. That's the work that we're doing, and that's what Jacob is showing us how to do. It's not, because Jacob's life, at the end of his life, when he meets Pharaoh, when he goes down to Egypt to be reunited with Joseph, and he says, basically Pharaoh says, you look pretty old. And he says, my life, you know, the days of my life, they've been long and hard. They've been hard. He didn't say I've had a good life. I mean, he's held accountable for saying that. He shouldn't have said that. But says, look at his life. Your brother wants to kill you. Your father-in-law cheats you and then wants to kill you. And then maybe your brother wants to kill you again. Then your sons sell one of your sons into slavery and you don't see him for 22 years. And your daughter is raped. Okay, and then your sons also then kill a whole community and think, like, what's going to happen to me? You can't really say, I've had an easy life. Okay, he did not have the sit back that people think, oh, you know, a life of Torah, a life of Judaism, those are people who like want to be disconnected from reality and just, you know, I don't know, have some sort of otherworldly existence. It's like, no, it isn't. The world is the world that goes back, to wrap up, the very beginning when we saw is on page 145, what is our life really? What is our life really? Is if we look at the ladder of spiritual growth. Where is it in verse 12? Let's take a look at that. Where do we leave off in reading? Verse 12, and he dreamt.
And he dreamt, and behold, a ladder was set earthward, and its top reached heavenward, and behold, angels of God were ascending and descending on it.
Okay, and so what is this Sulam that we've drawn so much insight into what the Sulam stands for? Where is it? Where are its feet?
Earthward.
Earthward, and where is its head?
Heavens.
It says, that is the model of the Jewish person. Where are we? It says, we are planted very firmly. People say, oh, you just live in another world. You don't live in reality. It's like, seriously not. The Torah is about reality. It's how to encounter reality, how to make choices in real life situations, and to do so in a way that brings us to spiritual growth and wholeness and completeness. Yaakov is being told, this is you. You are a sulam. You are a ladder. Your feet are on the ground. You're going to be dealing with things that are very much of this world, but your head is in the heavens, meaning your head. And we don't mean this like when you say, so, oh, their head's in the clouds. We mean your head, your intellect, is in the Torah. Your head is in focused on God, what God wants from you, what your spiritual mission is, and you are going to integrate it. It doesn't say anything that there's a disconnect. In fact, by definition, a ladder means that it's connected, that there are rungs connecting it from the top to the bottom. That's the definition of what a ladder is. And that you were, how are you going to go? You're going to go like the angels, up and down, up and down. Learn the Torah, come down and work it. Learn the Torah, come down and work it. You're going to be up and down. That's what we do. So that's what we do. We learn Torah, and then all of us are going out of this room, and then we're going to go do whatever it is that we do, informed by what we have learned of how do we do what we do. Yaakov learns, how do I do what I'm supposed to do? And he asks God for God's protection. That's the best protection God can give us. Is, I can teach you how to do what you're supposed to do in the way that is most spiritually beneficial, that will lead you to the greatest heights, so that you too will be at the highest level you can be. In fact, I want you to see, you're going so high on this path. Your face is on my throne of glory. That's who you are. This ladder is the throne of glory. How do we ascend? That we actually go up this ladder. We go up through the challenges. We go up through everything that we are supposed to experience in our life. So back to the sulam of it equaling the 136, Torah, tefillah, and tzedakah of the voice and the fasting and tzedakah of money. You only do teshuva if you make mistakes. Okay? Otherwise, there's no teshuva to do. So by definition, life is going to be about making mistakes. Tefillah, you only do if you are in need and that you're praying for something. So we talk about we're in a place of need. And tzedakah means that there are people who don't have, that we're in a position to give. So it means those are real world situations. That's what this ladder is about. Yaakov is being told, go out there, live your life, use this as your ladder for your own spiritual growth, and you are reaching the entire height and depth and beauty of the Kisei HaKavod, of that throne of glory. Yaakov, with all of that, is able to then move on and deal with all of the pushback he gets in every part of his life to be able to really take himself to be the patriarch, the choicest patriarch, the one who has resilience, whose feet are on the ground, head is in the Torah, and is able to live his life and teach us those valuable lessons. Have a wonderful Shabbos. We'll see you next week.